From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Texaco dumps on indigenous lands. A national ad campaign blasts the oil giant for racial discrimination, this time in the Amazon rainforest. Also, Kathy Lee Gifford is once again criticized for her continued use of sweatshop labor in El Salvador. And almost a year after former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet was first arrested in Britain, his extradition trial begins today. We'll speak with the head of a Chilean exile group in London. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Now that Indonesian troops have officially given up control of East Timor, international peacekeepers are spreading out. After the handover of the territory to the multinational force today, Australian troops moved into a town not far from the capital of Dili. That brings to three the number of towns under control of the peacekeepers. They found a town almost totally destroyed, with only a few residents and at least two corpses. Australia's Major General Peter Cosgrove, the commander of the peacekeepers, says about 1,500 Indonesian soldiers will remain until a special assembly ratifies the overwhelming pro-independence vote cast by East Timorese in August. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Madeleine Albright met yesterday in New York with Xanana Gusmao, the man expected to lead an independent East Timor. She warned Indonesia risks losing American aid and investment unless it protects refugees in areas it controls. Albright's warning was one of the strongest yet by Washington, which has been reluctant to threaten sanctions against Indonesia, site of much U.S. business. It was also the first time Washington had made clear it would hold Jakarta accountable for behavior beyond the border of East Timor. Albright was in New York for the United Nations General Assembly session, and she was talking about the threat to between 100 and 200,000 refugees who were forcibly placed in West Timor during the siege of violence backed by the militias. Commenting on a report from her Assistant Secretary of State for Refugees who'd just been in East and West Timor, Albright said, "What she has reported to me is terribly troubling," and warned of further action against Indonesia. The United States has already suspended military aid, and a review of other aid is currently underway. Meanwhile, Australia's new plan to play a broader role in Asian peacekeeping is stirring criticism among its Asian neighbors and among politicians at home concerned by the use of Australian troops to use the UN-backed peacekeeping force in Timor. Australian Prime Minister John Howard overturned decades of foreign policy principles last week when he outlined plans for a more assertive, militarily prepared Australia that will play a broader role in Asian peacekeeping. There's been another explosion in Russia, this one coming today outside a shopping mall in St. Petersburg. News reports say a small bomb exploded outside the mall. No one was hurt. The Tartas news agency says the bomb left a small crater. A suspect reportedly has been detained. Russia has been hit with a wave of bombings in recent weeks. Officials are blaming Chechen rebels for the blasts. NATO Secretary General today urged Kosovo's political leaders to work for ethnic reconciliation, warning they will be held responsible for future acts of violence. Secretary General Javier Solana also endorsed a newly emerging force made up predominantly of former Kosovo Liberation Army fighters, while emphasizing that unlike its predecessor, it's meant to be apolitical and civilian in nature. Serbs have reacted to the new organization's creation with outrage, asserting it perpetuates the KLA under a new name and thus takes Kosovo another step on the way to independence from Serbia, Yugoslavia's dominant republic. This news from Turkey. Prisoners held more than 90 prison guards hostage in seven prisons across the country to protest the killing of 10 comrades in a prison riot. Security forces fired tear gas and stormed a ward holding 50 prisoners at Ankara's Ulukanlar prison yesterday to avert their escape through a tunnel they'd allegedly been digging. Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak won his fourth six-year term, taking 93.79% of the vote in a referendum on his presidency, this according to his interior minister today. And in this country, Philadelphia Mayor Ed Rendell has taken back his endorsement of Vice President Gore for the Democratic nomination. He says it's nothing against Gore. It's just that he's now the general chair of the Democratic Party, and in his new position, he cannot endorse a candidate. Rendell endorsed Gore for the Democratic nomination last year before former U.S. Senator Bill Bradley became a strong contender. And Vice President Dan Quayle has pulled out of the race for the Republican nomination for president. A Florida sheriff is using his official government website to denounce abortion and attack gays, feminists, atheists, and the American Civil Liberties Union. After quoting the preamble to the U.S. Constitution, Lee County Sheriff John McDougall takes a stab at what he calls the diabolical forces of moral corruption: Planned Parenthood, politicians, liberal judges, cyber porn, music videos, and the United Nations One World Government radicals, among others. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. 3 years after talk show host Kathy Lee Gifford pledged to end labor abuses at the maquiladora that makes her brand name apparel, she's once again being charged with running a sweatshop, this time in El Salvador. Two fired workers from the sweatshop, the Caribbean Apparel Factory in Santa Ana, have made these charges in news conferences in the past week in New York and Washington, as well as in meetings with members of Congress. They say they were fired after organizing their co-workers for better wages and labor conditions. They also say that conditions at the factory were unbearable, with women being forced to work overtime without pay, suffering from constant harassment and intimidation from factory supervisors. At a news conference last week in Washington, D.C., Kathy Lee Gifford's husband, Frank Gifford, confronted the former workers and Charles Kernighan, the head of the National Labor Committee, the human rights organization that exposes sweatshop conditions in U.S. Factories around the world. The teary-eyed Frank Gifford, former football star, accused Charlie Kernighan and the workers of making his children cry for attacking his wife, Kathy Lee Gifford. Democracy Now! Contacted both Halmode Apparel Incorporated, which handles the contract between Caribbean Apparel and Walmart, where the clothes are sold. A representative of the company said they were not making statements to the media. We also contacted ABC to invite Kathy Lee Gifford on, but our calls were not returned. We're joined right now by Charles Kernighan, head of the National Labor Committee, as well as the workers who were fired from the El Salvador plant. We're also joined by one of the union organizers who was working with those two young women. And I'm hoping maybe we'll be as lucky as Charlie Kernighan was at the Washington news conference, that maybe Frank Gifford will charge into the studio as we're speaking this morning. So, Frank, if you're listening, we welcome your comments. But Charles Kernighan, let's start with you. Can you lay out what this is all about?
Well, like you mentioned, Kathy Lee Gifford 3 years ago did promise to end sweatshop abuses. And she said that to guarantee that, she would open her factories to independent inspection by local religious and human rights and women's organizations and labor rights groups who the workers know and trust. She also said she'd pay workers a living wage so they could live in dignity. And, of course, none of those agreements were fulfilled. And here in El Salvador, at a place called Caribbean Apparel, which is inside a free trade zone called the American Free Trade Zone, it's a typical operation surrounded by barbed wire, the concrete, 15-foot concrete walls, the locked metal gates, and the armed thugs. Well, behind those guards and the barbed wire, it's very easy for them to exploit these workers, most of them who are single mothers and young women. And 60-cent wages meets about a third of the cost of living. The forced pregnancy tests for new workers, if they're positive, if they test positive, they're fired. The high production goals, the screaming at the workers, the locked bathrooms. But the biggest aspect of these factories is the fear. In El Salvador, in this factory, as well as others, every single worker knows that they'll be fired if they question working conditions or wages. Every single worker knows that they'll be fired if they cannot work overtime because their child's sick. Every single worker knows that if they're even seen grouping together, the management will think they're trying to organize a union and they'll be fired. If the management actually suspects them of organizing, they're fired and blacklisted. So when this information was presented, I think what Walmart attempted to do and Ms. Gifford attempted to do.
Now, just to explain, Kathy Lee Gifford, her clothing line is sold by Walmart.
Yes, her clothing line is made in the Caribbean Apparel factory, and she's an exclusive label for Walmart. In fact, the Kathy Lee Gifford label is the most successful private label ever introduced in the history of the United States. So they've done very well off the Kathy Lee Gifford label. Now, I think what the attempt of Walmart has been, and Hal Mode, and Ms. Gifford, and Frank Gifford, was to shift the focus from the real issue of the violation of these women's rights, of conditions in the factory, the fact that they were paid 15 cents for every $16.96 pair of pants they made. They wanted to shift it back to themselves so that Kathy Lee was crying and saying, you know, I demand that these vicious attacks be ended against me. And then Frank would say, it's a character assassination and the children are crying. Don't you realize that? Well, it may come as a surprise to them, but the world does not revolve around Mr. Gifford, Kathy Lee Gifford, and their two children. There are other people in the world. And hundreds of thousands of women locked into these factories behind the barbed wire who are stripped of their rights, paid starvation wages, go home to one-room hovels where they raise their children on coffee because they can't afford milk. They also exist in this world. And this is the issue. And what Walmart and Kathy Lee is trying to do is take the focus off the real issues. And that's why it's so important that these workers have a chance to speak.
Well, let's hear from some of these workers. Lorena Del Carmen Hernandez Moran is with us, as well as Blanca Ruth Palacios. They are former workers at the Caribbean Apparel Factory in Santa Ana, El Salvador, and they're being translated by Barbara Briggs of the National Labor Committee. Welcome to Democracy Now.
Gracias.
Let's begin with Lorena Del Carmen Hernandez Moran. Tell us about the factory you worked in. When did you work there?
I worked in the company for 2.5 years. And we saw the maltreatment every day, that the supervisors would smash the tables when the production goal or when we weren't producing enough. In that way, they wanted to make us work. They wouldn't let us go to the bathroom only once in the morning, once in the afternoon. A lot of compañeras lost, pregnant women lost their babies. They gave us hot water to drink. The bathrooms were dirty. They denied our permission to go to the Social Security clinic.
Los supervisores, si alguien no les hacía caso, lo despedían.
And the supervisors, if they were attracted to a woman and she didn't pay attention to them, maybe they would fire her. We'd go into work at 10 minutes to 7. They just gave us 40 minutes for lunch. And we'd get out at 6:10 at night. And sometimes they keep us working until 9:40.
Now, were you making clothes for the Kathy Lee Gifford line? How did you know that you were making her clothes?
Nosotros no dábamos cuenta de quién era la ropa hasta que miramos la viñeta, porque hubo un tiempo que yo pegué viñeta.
Well, we didn't know it was her clothing until we saw the labels, but then for a while I was working putting the labels on the clothing.
What did the labels say?
¿Y qué decía la viñeta?
Solo estaba la marca, solo decía Kathy Lee, lo
demás. It just said Kathy Lee.
You're sitting next to Blanca Ruth Palacios. Welcome, Blanca. What about your experience? When did you work in the factory?
Bueno, yo me llamo Blanca Ruth Palacios.
My name is Blanca Ruth Palacios.
Trabajé un año en esa empresa.
I worked for a year in that factory.
Pero para entrar a esa empresa, me pedían un examen de prueba de embarazo.
But to go into that factory, they asked me for a pregnancy test.
Yo saqué de mi bolsillo los 90 colones.
I took the 90 colones out of my pocket.
Ya estando ahí adentro, me dijeron de que eran 42 colones que nosotros ganábamos.
When I went into work, when I started working there, they told us that our pay was 42 colones a day.
Pero sí me exigían horas extras desde cuando yo entré a trabajar.
But they also demanded overtime hours.
Me negaban permisos personales y el seguro.
They refused me permissions to be absent, personal absences, and also to go to the Social Security clinic.
Entonces, de ver todos esos maltratos, nosotros los organizamos a un sindicato.
So, seeing all of these maltreatments, we organized ourselves into a union.
Cuando ellos se dieron cuenta que nosotros estábamos organizados, sacaron a Sella del sindicato.
When they found out, when they realized that we were organizing, they fired 6 women from the union, who were with the union.
Tenemos yo voy como sobre 2 meses ya sin salario, sin nada.
So I've been for 2 months with no wage, with nothing.
Entonces ahorita, hoy que regrese a El Salvador, iré, que hallamos más tremendo porque ya tenemos las listas negras de no poder trabajar en ninguna empresa.
And now when we return to El Salvador, the situation will be even more difficult because we're now on the blacklist and we can't work in any other factory, in any factory.
What did they tell you when they fired you? Did they say it was because you were union organizing? You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now.
A mí el jefe personal que se llama Leonel Catota me dijo de que ellos estaban haciendo corte personal y incluso en ese corte personal iba yo, pero
the chief of personnel, Leon Catota, told us that we were that they were cutting personnel. And that I was on the list.
Yo le dije que raro que me estén haciendo corte personal porque está entrando gente a trabajar.
But I said it was strange that they were cutting personnel because they were hiring new people at the same time.
Cuando yo regresé a la línea, me dijo mi supervisora de que a mí me despedían y porque yo le dije que tenía duda, entonces ella me dijo que me despedían por haber organizado un sindicato.
When I returned to my production line, my supervisor told me, because I said I wondered about it, she said that they were firing me because of the union, because we had a union.
Lorena, you too were fired just a few weeks ago. Why?
When they fired me, Leonel Catota, the chief of personnel, called me to the office.
Me dijo de que yo estaba, iba a quitar corte de personal y lastimosamente yo había salido ahí.
And they, he told me that they were cutting personnel, and unfortunately, I'd come out on the list.
O sea, me dijo estaba despedida y aparte de eso, me llevó, como me pidió mis documentos y como no los cargaba, me llevó a la casa que los trajera.
And then he asked my documents for my IDs, but I didn't have them. And so then he loaded me into a car and brought me to the labor ministry, to my house to get the ID into the labor ministry. Then returned me to the factory, but he wasn't willing to, they'd given the severance pay documents, but he wasn't willing to give me the documentation of what my severance pay should be.
Me llevó a su oficina y me hizo que le firmara un documento.
He brought me to his office and he made me sign a document.
Después de firmarle el documento, me llevó a otra oficina donde estaba el señor Martin Young y el señor Choi.
Then he took me to another office and Mr. Martin Young and Mr. Choi were there.
Y ellos me estaban ofreciendo más del 100% de dinero para que yo les dijera quiénes más de mis compañeras eran del grupo.
And then they wanted to offer me more than 100% severance pay, but only if I would tell them who else was in the group that was organizing.
Yo le dije que no sabía y me dijo que por mis hijos yo tenía que colaborar con ellos.
I said I didn't know, but they said for my children I had to collaborate with them.
Y me dijo al final de eso me dijo de que si a los 3 días yo no le daba ni una noticia por el teléfono, iba a mandar reporte a todas las empresas para que no me volvieran a dar trabajo en ninguna parte.
And then finally he told me that he'd give me 3 days, and if in 3 days I didn't give him information about who the other members of the group were, that he would send a message to all the other factories so that they would never give me a job.
Y ahí me fueron a dejar porque ellos no me dejaron que me fuera antes en los buses de la empresa.
Finally they let me go, because before when the buses left from the company they wouldn't let me go.
You're listening to the stories of Lorena del Carmen Hernandez Moran, former worker at the Caribbean Apparel Factory in Santa Ana, El Salvador, and Blanca Ruth Palacios also worked there until just a few weeks ago, when they were fired for union organizing. This is the plant that makes the Kathy Lee Gifford line of clothes exclusively for Walmart. When we return, we'll also continue with Charlie Kernighan and Giovanni Fuentes, who is one of the union organizers with the Federation of Independent Unions and Associations in El Salvador. His life was threatened for his involvement in union organizing at the plant. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman as we talk about the Kathy Lee Gifford line of clothes made at the Caribbean Apparel Factory in Santa Ana, El Salvador. Kathy Lee Gifford in the headlines a few years ago when Charlie Kernighan of the National Labor Committee exposed first the sweatshops in which clothes were made for her line of clothing. Now back in the headlines this past week, because when the National Labor Committee held a news conference in New York and in Washington, in one case, the owner of the, was it the factory, Charlie?
No, it was the owner of Halmode, which does the label for Kathy Lee Gifford.
The owner of Halmode came to that news conference, and in Washington, Frank Gifford, the well-known football player and husband of Kathy Lee Gifford, came to the Washington news conference, crashed it, and got to the mic and said, "I resent what you've done to my wife. You have assassinated her character." And he said that the criticism of Kathy Lee Gifford drove his children to tears. The question is, what happens to the children who work in the factories that Kathy Lee Gifford makes her money off of? Now, I do want to say we invited Kathy Lee Gifford as well as the representative of Halmode on, and none of them would come on. We're hoping maybe they'll crash this program as well.
Well, it doesn't surprise me. We asked for a meeting today, and of course, they rejected it.
Well, we're also joined in the studio by Giovanni Fuentes, coordinator of the Commission of the Maquila at the Federation of Independent Unions and Associations of El Salvador. His life has been threatened for involvement in union organizing. Can you tell us how you got involved with this particular plant, Giovanni? Barbara Briggs is translating from National Labor Committee.
Bueno, nosotros somos una federación que presta asistencia y asesoría legal a las trabajadoras.
We're a federation that gives assistance and legal aid to the workers.
En el mes de julio, las compañeras llegaron a FEACIES a pedirnos asesoría.
In July, the compañeras came to FEACIES to ask for help.
Comenzamos a escuchar las diferentes condiciones de trabajo que existían en la empresa Caribbean Apparel.
We began to hear from them about the different working conditions in the Caribbean Apparel Factory.
Comenzamos más o menos a asesorarlas sobre cuáles eran los requisitos legales que teníamos que cumplir
para poder organizar un sindicato en la empresa. That they had to fulfill in order to organize a union in the company.
Fue así como el 7 de agosto.
And so on the 7th of August,
organizamos junto con las trabajadoras el sindicato de la empresa Caribbean
Apparel. Together we organized the Union of Workers of Caribbean Apparel.
El día 6 de septiembre nos reunimos con recibí una llamada telefónica del apoderado de la empresa.
On the 6th of September, I received a phone call from the lawyer for the company.
Me dijo que nos
He's also the legal representative for other maquila companies. He suggested that we meet in the
Yo
labor ministry.
Acepté porque esperaba una respuesta a los despidos de dos compañeras que
I accepted because we were waiting for a response regarding the firing of two compañeras from the factory.
En esta reunión, el abogado de la empresa me dijo que no me dijo nada por teléfono porque era muy importante.
In that meeting, the lawyer said that he hadn't been able to talk to me on the phone because it was something important.
De entrada, él me dijo, Giovanni, tenga cuidado.
And as we began, he said, Giovanni, be careful.
Hay un video circulando en todas las empresas maquiladoras.
There's a video circulating among all of the maquila companies.
Usted y una chelita, quien
you
ya fue
appear
despedida.
In it, and a light-skinned woman who was already fired.
Usted y sus amigos, cuídense.
You and your friends should be very
este
careful.
Video es una amenaza para las empresas.
This video represents a threat for the companies.
Retírese de su trabajo.
You should leave your work.
Esa es una mafia.
There's a mafia there.
Acuérdese que en este país por 100 colones matan a cualquiera.
Remember that in this country they can kill anyone for 100 colones.
El día 14 de septiembre nos volvimos a reunir con él en el Ministerio de Trabajo.
On September 14th we met with him again in the Ministry of Labor.
Y nos volvió a decir de que ahí estaba el video.
And he said to us again that there was the video.
Que lo iban a mandar a la Presidencia de la República.
That they were even going to send it to the President.
También nos dijo que Kathy Lee y otras marcas iban a retirar de la empresa.
He also said that Kathy Lee and other labels were going to pull out of the company.
You're listening to Giovanni Fuentes of the Federation of Independent Unions and Associations of El Salvador. And again, he was the he that you're referring to? That told you this when you went to the, when you had these meetings. And who made the threats?
Fue el abogado de la empresa.
It was the company's lawyer.
And this is Halmod?
¿Y este fue, de Halmod?
No, the Caribbean Apparel's company lawyer.
And the relationship between Halmod and Caribbean Apparel Factory, Charlie Kernighan?
Halmod owns the Kathy Lee label. Kelwood owns Halmod. And together they both sell it to Walmart. Walmart then contracts the work out to Caribbean Apparel in El Salvador, which, of course, is hidden away behind the barbed wire, and no one can have access to it.
Now, when the Halmod representative crashed your news conference in New York, he actually did make a promise. He didn't just act like he was crying like Frank Gifford.
Well, yes, he referred to Ms. Gifford as the Joan of Arc of sweatshops and went on to say that we pressed him on this, and we said, listen, what are you trying to hide? Why do you need to hide these factories around the world? Why can't you at least give the American people the names and addresses of your factories that make the Kathy Lee line of clothing and other clothing for Walmart and Kelwood? And we pressed him and pressed him on this, and he eventually shot out. He said, we have nothing to hide. There's no secrecy here. There's no cabal here. We'll give you the names and addresses of the factories. And we pressed him on that, and he said, yes, you can have the names and addresses of the factories. We have nothing to hide. Well, of course, the minute that the TV lights were shut off, he was already backpedaling and saying, well, maybe I can't, you know, I have to talk to other people at Kelwood and Walmart. And then the next day, they put out a press release saying that they refused to release the names and addresses of the factories for competitive reasons, which is a smokescreen. But the problem is when these people come to the press conferences, for us it was very interesting because once you get them talking, they make an awful lot of mistakes like, Robert Adler, he said that the 60-cent wages.
He's head of Halmod,
the one who came to the press conference. He said, well, you know, the pregnancy testing, that's a cultural issue. That's a cultural thing in El Salvador. And the 60-cent wages, he said, well, that's a large economic issue. We have no control over that. The government sets the wage. What can we do? And these are big economic issues, which I don't understand. And he kept going on like this. And so in some ways, when they come to these press conferences, it's quite interesting.
Lorena said she makes 42 colones a day. What does that come to?
$4.79. And they live, you can't live on those wages. I mean, it meets about a third of the cost of living. I mean, to meet basic necessities. The government of El Salvador defines 42 colones a day as extreme poverty. The minimum wages in many of these developing countries are arbitrarily set and have nothing to do with reality, and yet the companies hide behind that. I think people should understand, too, that they're returning to El Salvador tomorrow. They're returning to El Salvador under death threats, with firings and blacklisting, And they need help. In El Salvador, there's 225 factories, 70,000 young workers producing 581 million garments a year for export to the United States. There is not one single union. El Salvador is one gigantic sweatshop. And so we need to put an enormous amount of pressure to break this trap that the workers are in.
Charlie Kernaghan, we've had you on a number of times, but when you first made the attacks on the Kathy Lee Gifford line of clothing, now that propelled her onto the President's Apparel Task Force. What has happened? What has she done?
Well, it was so interesting, on her program the other
Live with Regis and Kathy Lee.
On her program the other day, she said, I can't monitor these factories all over the world. Nobody can. So, in a sense, here's one of the founding members of the FLA admitting
FLA being
the Fair Labor Association, which was set up by the White House and Nike and companies like Liz Claiborne. Here was Ms. Gifford on her own television program saying that the factories can't possibly be monitored. Now, Ms. Gifford says she spends $500,000 a year of her own money to monitor these factories. And then Kelwood jumps up and say, we spend $1 million to monitor these factories. But, of course, they're using Price Waterhouse and Cal Safety and these other for-profit monitoring groups who the workers, quite honestly, despise and distrust. When they see Price Waterhouse or Cal Safety, they're talking to the local maquila owner. They know that, and they know if they say anything damaging, they will be fired, and they'll be out of there. So we've explained this to Ms. Gifford over and over again, that the only people who could monitor the factories would be these local groups that have a long record in the defense of human rights and women's rights, who the workers trust. If Ms. Gifford, with the $500,000, if she handed that money over to local groups, she could fund, in 33 different countries, she could give $15,000 to local organizations to monitor those factories, and the job would get done. But what they want to do is continue with this corporate cover-up. I think the Fair Labor Association is completely dead in the water. Students are going to blow it right out of the water this fall.
Well, explain the Fair Labor Association, because it's sort of taken on different names. This is the White House Task Force?
Yes. After the original Kathy Lee Gifford scandal, the White House had to do something. So there was too much publicity, too much pressure. So they said, let's have a private organization to take over respect for labor rights and worker rights. And so they brought together Nike and Adidas and a couple of other companies, and Liz Claiborne and Kathy Lee Gifford, and unions and religious organizations, and they came up with a code of conduct and a monitoring system. The monitoring system and the code of conduct was so weak that the unions left. Unite, the apparel workers unions left, the AFL-CIO left, the religious organizations left, and what remained was the companies and a handful of tiny NGOs that had no constituencies. They came up with a monitoring system, which was such a corporate whitewash. They said that the companies could choose and pay for the monitors. They said that the companies would have the most significant say in which factories would be chosen for monitoring. Of course, the companies would be alerted ahead of time. Of course, the companies would choose Price Waterhouse. They would enter the factories for a one-day visit. They would talk to the workers inside the factories. They would keep this information confidential. It would go back to the company. And then on the basis of these confidential reports, at the end of the year, the company would write a summary of these investigations, and that's what they were going to present to the American people. No living wage, no corporate disclosure, no transparency in the monitoring. It was a complete, total whitewash, and I think we're seeing a collapse right now.
Blanca Ruth Palacios, or Lorena Del Carmen Hernandez Moran, were you ever working when one of these monitoring groups, when Price Waterhouse came in? Folks, you're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we talk about this expose, once again, of the Kathy Lee line of clothes that are exclusively sold at Walmart.
Sí, llegaron como dos
Blanca Ruth Palacios.
Nosotros. Pero cuando ellos llegaban, hacían la empresa.
This is Lorena.
Yes, they used to come, but when they came beforehand, they'd clean the factory. They changed the water bottles. They'd let us go to the Social Security clinic. They didn't demand the same production goal. They'd paint the factory. They cleaned up the production lines. They wouldn't scream at us.
Que iba a llegar un grupo, pero no decía de monitoreo, sino que van a venir personas que les van a hacer preguntas.
And the supervisor, as we were entering that day, would say, he wouldn't say monitoring, he would say a group of people are going to come who might ask questions.
Que él esperaba que nosotros le contestáramos bien o que los tratara, que ellos nos trataban bien.
And they would say that they hoped that we would answer, that we would answer well, that they treated us well, and that working in the company was excellent. Because if not, we would lose the work if we answered otherwise.
As we wrap up, let me ask you each why you've come here to tell the story to the United States. You already lost your jobs. You risk not ever being able to get a job in a factory in El Salvador. What's in this for you?
Porque nosotros pensamos de que de aquí sí se puede un apoyo a que presionen a más que a Kathy Lee, porque ella, así como cambió otros lugares de trabajo, puede cambiarlos en la empresa.
We think that here there can be, we can get support to put pressure on Kathy Lee, because like she's changed other workplaces, she can put pressure on the company to change the company.
Sí, lo que nosotros queremos es que nos retiren las marcas de todo lo que se hace, porque nosotros desde del trabajo de aquí de Estados Unidos vivimos, sobrevivimos ahí.
What we want is that these labels should not leave, because we live on this work in El Salvador.
No queremos que cierren la empresa también.
And we don't want the factories to close either.
Queremos que siempre sigan mandando más trabajo, que estamos dispuestos a trabajar
duro. We want them to keep sending more work, and we're willing to work hard.
Más que todo lo que nosotros queremos es que se los de nuevo el trabajo.
What we want is that they should give us the work.
Blanca, what was your response to Frank Gifford, Kathy Lee's husband, when he said, "You're making his children cry"? Coming up, by the way, we're going to be talking about the extradition trial of Pinochet that is beginning in London today.
Nosotros, pues porque nosotros hablamos en realidad los derechos de que los respeten los derechos de nosotros allá en la empresa,
well,
no solo por nosotros, sino que todo
rights,
El Salvador.
They should respect our rights there in the factory, and not just for us, but for all the workers in El Salvador.
Y que se le ponga ya fin a todo esto.
And that an end should be put to all of these maltreatments.
Giovanni, why are you risking your life since they've threatened you? By my calculation, by the way, 100 colones, which they said they could kill him for, is something like $10 for organizing at the Caribbean Apparel factory.
Bueno, yo creo que como una federación encargada de mejorar las condiciones de trabajo en El Salvador.
Well, I think as a federation responsible for working to improve conditions, working condition in El Salvador, the thing we can least do is stay quiet.
Nuestro trabajo estamos ayudando, estamos apoyando a 70,000 trabajadoras.
With our work, we are helping and supporting 70,000 workers to put an end to the maltreatment and the bad working conditions, to work to guarantee that they should live as people with dignities and not just production machines.
And finally, Charlie Kernighan, as listeners hear this story once again, what do you think that they can do? What role can people play in making conditions better?
Well, no one's given up here. In other words, they want their jobs back. They want to be reinstated with back pay. They want the maltreatment in the factory ended. They don't want Kathy Lee Gifford and the other labels to pull out. They want the union recognized, and they want independent verification of factory conditions. So this isn't over yet. And the only people that can really put pressure on the American companies is us, is the American people. They go back to El Salvador, they'll do their job in the face of death threats and firings. They're doing just fine, but they're crushed every time they move. What we need to do is just put enormous pressure on Walmart and Kathy Lee Gifford and the students across the country, United Students Against Sweatshops. At the last count, I think there's going to be 25 demonstrations on college campuses tomorrow, the day they go back. We're going to see enormous actions in the United States. People should call us to get involved. This really is, we're drawing a line in the sand.
What's your phone number?
It's a 212 area code, 242-3002. You know, Kathy Lee Gifford's threatening to pull her work from all over the world. She said, all right, you keep criticizing me, You keep these personal attacks, and I'm going to dump all those people in the street. So it's the same corporate threat they do all the time. If the workers speak up, you put the gun to their head, and you tell them, shut your mouth or you're in the gutter. So this is a big case.
One more time, the number of the National Labor Committee.
212 area code, 242-3002, and we have updates and packages to send out on this case.
And any number of Walmart or the Kathy Lee Gifford line of clothing?
Well, they should call ABC to try to reach Kathy Lee Gifford, and that's 212-456-7777. And if you want to fax her a little note, it's 800-330-1106.
That ABC number is 212-456-7777. I want to thank you all for being with us. Charlie Kernaghan of the National Labor Committee, which is based in New York, as well as Lorena del Carmen Hernandez Moran and Blanca Ruth Palacios, former workers at the Caribbean Apparel Factory, who would like to be current workers with improved conditions there, and Giovanni Fuentes, coordinator of the Commission of the Maquila at the Federation of Independent Unions and Associations of El Salvador. Barbara Briggs, thanks for translating. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Lawyers representing indigenous groups in Ecuador's rainforest launched an ad campaign against Texaco last week for polluting the environment where these communities live. Texaco was sued 6 years ago for dumping oil and toxic wastewater into Ecuador's rainforest between 1971 and 92. Overall, the company dumped three times more than the amount spilled by the Exxon Valdez disaster into one of the most biologically fragile places on Earth. The lawyers say that as Texaco continues to challenge their right to sue in courts, they're taking the facts to the public. In a recent press release, Texaco called the lawyers' ad campaign an outrageous publicity stunt to draw attention to unsubstantiated allegations leveled against the company. We have more on this story from Leslie George, who's a reporter with WBAI Pacifica Station here in New York.
The lawyers for the indigenous people of Ecuador who are suing Texaco say the advertising campaign, which began in today's New York Times, is aimed at exposing Texaco for its systematic dumping of more than 16 million gallons of oil and toxic wastewater in the Ecuadorian Amazon over a 21-year period. Initially filed in November 1993, the lawsuit alleges, among other things, that the dumping was deliberate on the part of Texaco's high-ranking officials. Stephen Donziger is one of the lawyers representing the Cofan, the Sequoia, and the Siona, who live in the region affected by Texaco's dumping.
Texaco, when they made the decision to build the oil infrastructure in Ecuador, neglected to do one thing that every other oil company at the time was doing throughout the world, which was to install reinjection wells. So when toxic wastewater that comes up with the oil, it's an inevitable byproduct of drilling for oil. When it comes up, it's then reinjected back into the ground. It's very toxic water. It's very poisonous water. Over time, all of this toxic wastewater, which is highly carcinogenic, spread and leached into the groundwater, spread into the rivers to the point where now you simply cannot drink clean water in rivers in this region of Ecuador. Texaco's executives made a conscious decision not to build reinjection wells. They thought they could save money, and they did it because they felt like, hey, we'll just wash it off into the streams and rivers. It's wetlands. It's Amazon. It's jungle. I mean, no one's really living there. What they neglected to understand or appreciate was that there were thousands of people living there, indigenous tribes, who had lived there for centuries with a particular way of life that was very dependent on the sustainability of the rainforest.
Donziger says the ad campaign is being launched not only to educate the public about Texaco's dumping, but to show how racist Texaco's policies are. In the television ad, a Texaco oil truck pulls into a suburban neighborhood, and as the driver gets out, two Caucasian children and their father stand in the yard. As the narrator speaks, the driver takes a hose pumping out oil and spews it all over them and the house behind them.
There's a company with a history of racial and ethnic discrimination, Texaco. Skin color matters to them. So Texaco would never do what you're about to see to people who look like this. But this is what Texaco did in the rainforest in Ecuador. For years, they dumped millions of gallons of oil waste full of toxins and carcinogens. That oil waste destroyed the lives of thousands of people of color in Ecuador. Imagine if they did that in your neighborhood.
When Texaco drills in Louisiana and California, says Donziger, or where large numbers of white people live, they do it safely and according to industry standards. The lawyers also unveiled an ad for radio that points out the contradiction between Texaco's generous support for the Metropolitan Opera and other arts organizations in the United States as it carries out policy that helped destroy the culture of those outside America.
Texaco is known for its generous support of opera, but the company sings quite a different aria in the rainforest of Ecuador. There, Texaco has brought devastation. Beginning in 1971, Texaco drilled for oil in Ecuador with methods it had stopped using where white people lived and made billions in profits. This disregard for people of color is part of a pattern at Texaco. In 1996, the company paid $176 million to settle a racial discrimination suit brought by its minority employees. In Ecuador, Texaco dumped the poisonous water produced by its oil drilling, killing the rivers that form the headwaters of the Amazon. Many of the indigenous people were forced to flee their homeland. For those who remain, cancer rates are already abnormally high. This tragedy is brought to those people every day by Texaco.
It's part of their corporate culture to not care as much about people of color than about white people.
Stephen Donziger.
They would never do this in the United States. They would never do this what they did in Ecuador in the neighborhoods in which Texaco's executives live in Westchester County, New York. The only reason I can think of that they did this because they cared less about the indigenous people of Ecuador than they do about people they're used to. And that is race discrimination. And that's why we're emphasizing this in this ad, not only because it happened in this instance, but because Texaco is a company, based on its previous admissions in the earlier lawsuit brought by its own employees, it is a company with a culture, a corporate culture, of that has some discriminatory tendencies. And they need to deal with that. And one of the ways they can deal with it is to go back to Ecuador and clean up the mess they left behind that has caused so much suffering to the people of the region.
The lawsuit on behalf of the indigenous Ecuadorian people is currently in federal court in the Southern District of New York. It is pending a decision on Texaco's pretrial motion to dismiss the lawsuit, the company's sixth round of motions to dismiss the suit since it was filed 6 years ago. Texaco spokesperson Faye Cox says the company is outraged by the ad campaign and that its allegations are unsubstantiated.
The plaintiffs have continued to allege a number of claims against the company. Texaco did act responsibly. There's no credible scientific evidence to say that the industry practices there had lasting environmental impact or health impacts.
Is it true what the plaintiffs claim, that the standards used for drilling in this part of Ecuador are different than the standards used in the United States?
We used standard industry practices in Ecuador that are accepted around the world.
But that are not used in the United States.
When we started operations in Ecuador back in the 1960s, nowhere in the world were there the environmental regulations that we have today. At the time we were operating there, we used standard industry practices that were used around the world.
Toribio Aguinda Lusitante, who is in New York representing the Cofan peoples, says when he was a young boy, the Cofan lived peacefully and healthfully, hunting and fishing as their ancestors did for generations. Now he says he has four children who have never seen a rainforest.
Ahora actualmente ya no tenemos selva.
Well, right now we have no rainforest.
Y también
no jungle.
Ya no tenemos agua limpia donde bañar.
We don't have clean water where we can take a bath, where we can bathe.
Todo el agua está con petróleo.
All of the water has oil in it.
Entonces, no tenemos árboles, no tenemos selva. Yeah.
We don't have trees, we don't have the type of jungle we had.
Ya está totalmente destruido toda nuestra selva.
And our environment has been completely destroyed.
A recent study of inhabitants of one village showed a dramatic rise in cancer rates. But Cristobal Bonifaz, co-lead counsel in the case against Texaco, says that study is not a true barometer of the true consequences of Texaco's dumping. He says the study was conducted at the region's one clinic, which has only 14 beds. He says women would never have the money to travel to the clinic, for example, nor would they travel alone. And in fact, few men dying of cancer would make it to the clinic either. Instead, he says, 50% of the patients are there for burns. Bonifaz says most of the people who live in this part of the Amazon have buckets of gasoline at the front door of their huts, which they use to wash the oil off their hands and feet.
When they reach their hut, they actually dunk their feet in gasoline as they come into their houses. They wash them with the gasoline as if it was water. They walk in. Now, this has two problems. Why gasoline is not something you wash your hands or your feet with. You have benzene there, you have carcinogenic products. So that is one problem. But the other problem, which is more immediate, is that a lot of this gasoline, because it's open all the time, you know, for some mistake, catches fire. Nobody keeps an empty bucket of gasoline by your door, and that's what these people are doing. And the tragedy is this one hospital, you go there, 50% of the beds are occupied always by severe burns from the fires. So there's at least 7 beds for a community of 150,000 people to take care of the other problems like cancers. The reality is that most people who have a cancer simply die.
Donziger says the White Plains paper, where Texaco is based, refused to run the print ad which awards Texaco with a badge of shame. Later this week, Toribio Aguinda Lusitante will return to Ecuador to his indigenous community of the Cofan. Today there are only about 800 members of that community. When Texaco first ventured into the country, there were 15,000. I'm Leslie George.
That report by Leslie George of Pacifica Station WBAI in New York. And as we wrap up today's program, we're moving to London, where, as he puts it, the only political prisoner in England is having an extradition hearing. That is General Augusto Pinochet. Almost 1 year after the former Chilean dictator was arrested in London on a Spanish arrest warrant, Britain Today began a 5-day hearing on whether he should be extradited to Spain to face charges of torture and other human rights abuses. Prosecutors at the packed hearing on behalf of the Spanish government detailed 35 charges of torture dating from December of 1988 to December of 1989. They also accused Pinochet of orchestrating a systematic campaign of terror during his final 15 months in power. Deputy Chief Magistrate Ronald Bartle will decide on the case. He's a conservative who has a close association with former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, one of Pinochet's chief supporters. We now go live to the Bow Street Magistrates Court in London, where the hearing is taking place, and Reid Brody of Human Rights Watch, he's advocacy director there, has just stepped out of the courtroom to speak with us. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Reid. Can you tell us what is happening right now?
Well, right now the prosecutor, Alan Jones, is finishing reading the charges. What's really been, I think, historic today is that after 25 years, to have in a court of law the court clerk read out during 20 minutes the charges against General Pinochet, and then have the prosecutor, Alan Jones, list the names of victims and detail the torture methods, the grill, the parrot, breaking of limbs, hangings, electric shocks to the penis. To have these dramatic charges read out in court of law for the first time is, I think, and the names of victims is really a vindication for the thousands of people who were brutalized during Pinochet's regime.
And what happens now? So they read them out. Is General Pinochet, by the way, there?
No, General Pinochet has been excused from participating. He's at in his rented London mansion. He will have to come here when the judge reads out the decision in a couple of weeks after the hearing is over. What's going to happen is there are obviously going to be some serious legal debates, first as to whether Spain has jurisdiction over the case now that in the post-88 cases there are no Spanish victims, whether or not Judge Garzón had the right to add new facts and new charges after the second House of Lords decision, and also whether or not the disappearances cases will be allowed. The prosecution has presented a list of 1,198 people who were disappeared in the early years of the Pinochet regime, and has alleged that by concealing the whereabouts of these persons who were detained, that the Chilean regime continued to inflict mental anguish on the families of the victims, and that this were, and that these were continuing cases of torture. They're supported in that by the UN Declaration on Torture and by several decisions of UN and OAS human rights bodies, but it's the first time that the British courts are going to test that theory, that, that disappearances are considered continuing acts of torture.
Reed Brody, we're also joined by Carlos Reyes, who is a representative of Chile Democratico, which is the oldest Chilean exile group in Britain. He was a prisoner under the Pinochet regime in the 1970s for 2 years. Carlos, as Reed described the list of tortures, are they familiar to you?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think it's, in reality, these few torture who our colleague was mentioned is they're not enough really with, or, then, or I would say a very pallid reflection of what really happened in Chile. It's more than that. It's really the brutality. It's unbelievable. It's describe in words what they did to us or they did to many people.
Carlos, you were in the courtroom this morning as well as the judge read it out.
No, I wasn't. We choose to let another people to come in, you know, big people come from
Chile. Of your group?
Yes, yes. We decided from to some of the victims, direct victim to inside, you know, and that's why I wasn't there. But I follow up on the case very closely.
What was your response to Pinochet's letter in the last week? Was it apologizing for the violence?
I don't think so. I don't think so. I completely disagree with that, with people think that he apologizing. I think it, before he can apologize, he must come clear, you know, come clean from the crime he committed against his own people. Especially, he must clearly say where are these, all the people who disappear. And also he must and clearly also stated that he apologized to Chile. Because it's not just against Chile, also against another country in the world. This is, but that's a very important point too.
Well, we plan to cover every day this extradition trial. Reed Brody, if none of the people are Spanish who were killed in the 1988-89 period that is being considered now, is it possible this extradition will be denied?
Well, the Spanish Audiencia Nacional, the national Spain's highest court, just at the end of last week reaffirmed Spain's jurisdiction over the case. So I'm not sure that a magistrate here is going to feel himself competent to look into the minutia of whether Spanish legislation permits or doesn't permit this kind of extraterritorial jurisdiction when its citizens are not involved. Torture is, under international law, an offense over which Spain can have jurisdiction. The question is whether Spanish legislation gives their courts that authority.
Reed, we're going to leave it there for now, but we will continue to cover the story each day this week as the hearing takes place in London. Reed Brody of Human Rights Watch in the courtroom right now in London. Carlos Reyes, a representative of Chile Democratico, and Chilean political prisoner himself, tortured under the Augusto Pinochet regime. That does it for the show. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, 1-800-735-0230 is the number to call. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Special thanks to Robert Knight, our engineer today, Matthew Finch. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
And see California through the eyes of Joan Didion in Slouching Toward Bed.
Are still being rejected for home loans at twice the rate of whites, according to a new report. And writer Todd Gitlin assesses the left's fractured response to U.S. military intervention. It's all coming up on Up for Air right after this morning's news with James Tuck.